Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Madeline Cunin is the former three-term governor of Vermont who served as the Deputy Secretary of Education and Ambassador to Switzerland under President Bill Clinton. In her new book, a memoir entitled Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s, the topic is aging, but she looks well beyond the physical tolls and explores the emotional ones as well. Cunin takes a close look at what it's like to grow old. The book is a memoir, yet an honest and positive look at aging and how it has affected her life. Again, the name of the new book is Coming of Age, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Governor Madeline Cunin to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm delighted to be on the program.
You know, I told you this recently, that when I was just starting in this job at this radio station, one of my first assignments was to week cover Vermont, and I called and I left a message with the governor's office and you returned my call. And I remember thinking that was the greatest thing in the world. Of I called the governor and the governor called me back. It says a lot about you, I think, and it also probably says a lot about the state of Vermont, doesn't it?
It does. It does. We're a small state, and I think things get a little more personal and hopefully responsible.
When you look back at those three terms, it seems that that was a job that you greatly enjoyed.
Well, I think it's governor is still one of the best jobs in politics and public life because you're still close to the public. They know who you are, and the downside is when you go shopping, it takes you twice as long because everybody has to tell you their story. But it makes politics real, not just an abstract or political exercise.
I will want to get into some of your accomplishments a little bit later on, but when it comes to the book itself, Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s, what did you want to explore?
Well, I guess in a way I wanted to explore myself, to figure out what was happening to me as I grew older and my physical changes, my emotional changes. And I also, after having left politics, I felt liberated. I didn't have to be so careful with what I said and how I said it. I could dig deeper into my memories and into my psyche and be more honest. And that's one of the advantages of getting out of politics. You don't have to wrap yourself in saran wrap and be anxious about every word you say. It's sort of liberating. And I think what I've discovered since is that people can identify with this book much more than I thought when I was writing it. I was kind of anxious. Was I saying too much? Was I making myself too vulnerable? But turns out that that's okay. The public likes to see you in a vulnerable position, and they can identify with you that way.
Do you think aging, just the natural act of aging, does in the end make us more vulnerable?
In a way, you're right, because you're more dependent on other people, and the very act of dependence makes you vulnerable. I mean, I'm still fortunate that I can drive, I can walk, I can take care of myself, but that will change with time. I guess the wish of every older person is that we stay independent for as long as possible and can manage our lives as we see fit. But the day will come when that is not possible. So you try to push that away as far as possible.
The book is certainly a memoir, and there are wonderful stories in it. You do begin with a poem, though, and I am hoping you can read us the poem at the beginning, which is titled 84 Years.
Thank you. 84 years. 84 years, my birthday, big as a stop sign, red blazing, the number blinks and calls me forward. This is who you are. I stop at the curb, waiting for the light to change, to let me move on like I always did when I was 44 and green.
Madeline Cunin reading from her book, Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. You say in the foreword that I wrote this memoir for the same reason that all memoirs are written, to fulfill a need for self-definition. What kind of self-definition were you looking for?
Well, just who I had become and who I was becoming. And does it all make sense? Does it, somehow putting it on paper or into the computer gives it a sense of completion, a sense of wholeness. And I think that's why memoirs are written, to try to understand what's happening to you. But I also, now that I reflect on it more, as a political person, wanted people to know more of who I actually am. In politics, everything is extreme. You're either liberal or conservative. Your decisions are good or bad. But there are lots of nuances in life. Like, you know, in my public life, I didn't talk about my family's experience with the Holocaust. That just never came up. I never talked about my father. And those are the things I feel shaped me and I feel most strongly about. So this book allowed me to delve into sort of some of the dark places and some of the bright places, too, of my life, which are never apparent in public life.
You have a chapter early on in the book in which you talk about, you state, I am not old. What does that word mean to you?
Well, that's a very tough question. What does it really mean? I mean, sometimes people think old is a state of mind. Like when I turned 84, I couldn't believe I was 84. And now I'm 85, and it still seems some distant point, not something that's really glued on to me. So I think it depends on your attitude as much as your physical condition. If you're still interested in life, if you're still curious about what's going to happen the next hour or the next day, if you can still enjoy things. I mean, sunsets aren't just for young romantic couples. They're also for old couples or old people to admire as a gorgeous phenomenon in the sky. So I think you just have to stay alive and stay engaged if you possibly can. I mean, the two big barriers for older people, and notice I said older, not old, is if you have financial insecurity and if you have poor health, that can slow you down. But I've met people who have both of those disabilities and still enjoy life. So it doesn't mean every day has to be cheerful, but it means you're still eager to live. That's the most important thing.
You write in the book, it comes later, you're actually writing about toilets, but I'll get to that in a second. And you say, I was at my first meeting of the powerful Joint Fiscal Committee, the money committees of the House and Senate. It was 1978. No sooner had I taken my seat at the table than nominations for officers were made and accepted in rapid order. Click, click. My delight caught in my throat. What had I missed? There must have been a meeting before the meeting, possibly in the men's room. I nominate Mrs. Cunin for secretary, Representative Peter Giuliani announced. I decline, I responded. I was certain that I did not want to slip into that female slot. Representative Giuliani decided to be funny. I say, let's make Mrs. Cunin chairman of the entertainment committee. They laughed. I seethed. My blood rose to my cheeks like mercury in a thermometer. They are mocking me. I am not being taken seriously. I'm here to entertain the men like a plaything or worse. It's my fault. The pressure behind my eyes became stronger. Please don't let me cry. You then talk about having to go to the bathroom to cry. And you also point out that the past year you've seen a newspaper photo of the newly appointed Joint Fiscal Committee and all four members were women. But it takes you, really, to make that happen, to make that possible for those four women.
Well, Perhaps. But yeah, it was one of those moments where you just feel it in your gut and you want to scream. But of course, you have to control yourself and be calm and collected and pretend that nothing's happened. Though I did encounter Mr. Giuliani later And I told him I was offended, and he was like, oh, my goodness, how surprising. I didn't know I was doing anything like that. So I think we all have to speak up. I mean, now with the Me Too movement, of course, the whole world is much more conscious of not only sexual harassment, but offense when you don't treat someone with respect. So it was a learning moment.
When you think about your achievements, though, as governor, as ambassador, deputy secretary of education, those were things that you achieved. Did you find those barriers in every job that you took?
Well, not really. I mean, I was also very much impressed by the excitement of having the job. Being elected governor was a big deal in the 80s, and I felt I was helping to lead the pathway to future women in these roles. I didn't realize it would take till 2018 for it really to burst on the scene. We've had a phenomenal election year this past election when women really burst out of their traditional roles and decided they wanted to be at the table where the decisions are made. So I think I had to climb over a barrier, but once you over it, you're safe in a way. And there are always little things that come up, but once you're elected governor, you're respected as a governor. And now many more women are making that transition. So the more of us there are, the less of an issue it will be. I mean, just the fact that three women have announced they're running for president. So the whole idea of a woman president may seem a little less controversial after they all put in their hats and throw in their hats, and maybe we won't focus 24/7 on what they're wearing or what hairstyle they have. I think it'll still take a bit, but then you have to talk about something else eventually.
You write in the book about when you were running for governor, you got a call that said, tell her not to wear gray stockings. I mean, that was a big deal.
Right. It was. Because, a woman in a man's role is almost a puzzle that the audience has to figure out. Is she behaving like a man or is she behaving like a woman? And the truth is, you have to do both. You have to be masculine up to a certain extent because our picture of leadership since time began has been masculine. But you have to be feminine too, because that's who you are. And the trick is to be authentic, to be comfortable in a male leadership role, but to also be true to yourself as a woman. And that takes some fine sketching to get the picture just right. And more women are doing that. And I think now the definition has broadened. Just look at the new women who were elected to Congress this election. I mean, they don't wear navy blue suits necessarily. If they could wear a red tie, they would try to, but they don't have to. They're wearing burkas, they're wearing elegant dresses, they're wearing down-to-earth clothing. So I think our description of what a female governor or female politician looks like has become a little bit broadened. You can't go all the way out off the deep end, but I think there's more tolerance for diversity than there ever was before.
Madeline Cunin is our guest. The name of the book is Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. Let me go from sexism to ageism, if I can. And I'm curious as to how you feel when people talk about certain candidates who are either very close to running for president, are running for president, or are expected to run for president. Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Vermont's own, even Elizabeth Warren, of saying that are they too old for the office? And is it better for us to have younger blood in that particular role, not in politics in general, but for the presidency. Is that a valid argument?
Well, I think it's a valid question to ask because, first of all, we have so much choice potentially in this for 2020. And I think there's something to the argument because if you're 78 now, you'll be 80 and then you'll be 84. I mean, one does lose something with age, certainly. I have to confess to that. I'm not as energetic as I once was. And I think it's a good question to ask. I'm not saying they should never run, but we should certainly question it and say, would there be a younger person who has the energy, the ideas, if not the long-term experience? I mean, ideally, we'd have a candidate who has long-term experience and still has fresh ideas and energy to do the job. But I don't think we have to feel guilty about questioning age.
You mentioned this earlier, and I wanted to come back to it. You write in a chapter entitled Searching for the Past, I am not a Holocaust survivor, but I harbor survivor's guilt. Tell us a little bit about that and why you wanted to write about it.
I wanted to write about it because the Holocaust has made a really strong impression on my life. Members of my family, an aunt and uncle, cousins were hidden, others were killed. And I feel that it was only good luck that brought me here. My mother brought me and my brother to America in 1940 at the outbreak of the war from Switzerland, which remained neutral, but we didn't know that at the time. So I feel that I, in a way, live a privileged life as a survivor. I could run for office. I could have the freedoms that my ancestors and my relatives couldn't have had. So I sometimes feel I'm a political person in part, only in part, because of the Holocaust, because I want to exercise the freedom of speech and of action that was given to me by this country.
When you say there was, it's a small part, but what do you think the other part is of the desire that you had to be a public servant?
I think the feminist movement, the women's movement, played a very strong part. I've always considered myself a feminist, but when the movement burst on the scene, I said, oh boy, here it is. This is something I deeply believe in gender equality. And the feminist movement of the 70s said, you know, you can do this. I always thought I'd get into, I'd either marry a politician. And Gloria Steinem said, you know, we have become the men we had wanted to marry, or else I would wait till my children all were in college. But Gloria and others said, don't wait. You can enter the fray right now. And so I did. And when I started in the Vermont legislature, I didn't know whether I would like it or if I would be any good at it. Speaking of not being good at it, I said that to an old-timer in politics when I was debating whether to run for the legislature. And he sucked on his pipe and he looked at me and he said, well, if you're no good at it, you won't stand out. so that gave me courage.
You write in this book about your love life. You write in this book about late in life love after losing your husband, right?
Right.
And then finding love again at 71. You have a lovely poem in here called I Loved You When You Did the Dishes. I'm hoping you can read that for us.
Okay. Yes, we had a very happy remarriage. Okay, I loved you when you did the dishes. I loved you. I cooked, you did the dishes. Did I love you for that? I listened to the distant clattering in the kitchen while I sat in my chair reading the newspaper. We shared most things then, but you did the driving, and I could sit still by your side with only a rare glance in the rearview mirror to check if it was safe to pass. Now I do everything, cook and wash the pots and meet the dishwasher's greedy demands. I make the bed, which you once made when we slept together. I push your wheelchair and straighten my back, not letting it sink into a stoop before it's time. I feel my muscles tighten up the incline. I wish you could feel it too from your glued position. You need me now to move in any direction, up and down and around corners, without bumping into things like winter boots thrown casually on the floor. I take the lead, pulling you out of yourself and into the world I inhabit. You visit me from time to time, like you used to do when you did the dishes and the counters always needed wiping. This evening is better than this morning when you berated yourself for growing old. What can I do? You asked, pleading with yourself. I whispered, nothing. Evenings are better. Evenings we meet on the sofa and talk about a story in the New York Times or a scene from the evening news. We are same-minded again. The world is spinning crazily out of its orbit. We shake our heads from side to side in rhythmic disbelief. I reach for your still hand, cover it with mine, and keep it there.
Madeline Kunin reading from Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. In the acknowledgments, you say your husband, John, is the hero of the book.
Well, he gave me the courage to write. Since we were married, I've written two books, and he read this book before he died, and he just had my back, as the saying goes, and it gave me the guts, I guess, to write more openly and hopefully more truthfully.
Madeline Kunin is our guest. The name of the book is Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. Toward the end of the book, you ask the question, how will I die? How much do you think about that?
Well, I do think about it, but it doesn't obsess me. I think, especially, I live in a retirement community where you see people getting more frail, and you see death more often. And, of course, you know that your future is not infinite as you thought when you were 25, and you think differently at 85. But I don't dwell on it. I try very much not to dwell on it because I want to live, and I want to enjoy what time is left, and I want to be engaged. So it's there. As I said, it's like a black crow sitting on your shoulder, and when he flies away, you still know he's in the neighborhood. But life is to be lived, and life is a wonder, and you certainly can enjoy life as you get older. In a way, you're more free to. You're not bound by young children. You have wonderful grandchildren who you can hug and then wave goodbye to. So you're in a way free to explore and do things you've never done before.
The book is Coming of Age. There's a beautiful picture of you on the cover. You write that you like the wrinkles.
Yes, I sort of do. Yes, I do, because I guess it gives me my character. That's who I am.
Absolutely. The book is gorgeous. It is Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s, and it is published by Green Writers Press. Madeline Kunin, what a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Well, it was my great pleasure. Thank you for speaking with me.
A delight. Again, Madeline Kunin's new book is Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. It is published by Green Writers Press. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.